Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update Call. Hancock Horizon Investments provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions during the call, please direct them to David_Lundgren@HancockHorizon.com, and he'll take them at the end of the call. Today we have Chief Investment Officer John Portwood and Investment Directors Greg Hudlewski, David Lundgren, and Jeffrey Tangus. With that, I'll pass the call on to David Lundgren, who will serve as the moderator.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to the call. John, how are you this morning?
Good, Dave. It's too bad where the markets are still in turmoil, but that's kind of the way it is these days.
Yeah. Before we get to the market, let's talk about the economy a little bit. And I sort of sense that we're seeing a little bit of improvement, and albeit modest. We're not headed to 4% or anything like that, it doesn't seem. But it seems like the numbers seem to be a little bit better than they have been. And possibly the odds of recession, even though they were low, say, 2-3 weeks ago, maybe they've been reduced a little bit. Is that a fair assessment of where we are?
It does look like the first quarter is going to be better than the last quarter of last year. I think everybody remembers the last quarter was pretty close to a 0.5% number. I think it was 0.7% real GDP as far as the initial estimate was concerned. It's been raised in the second estimate to about 0.9%, but the fourth quarter of last year was pretty weak. The track in the first quarter of this year looks like it's more in line with the 2% trend that we've seen for a very, very long time. Of course, that's pretty anemic. We've had a relatively anemic growth in the U.S. And really around the world. Ever since the crash, if you come forward from the crash, looking at U.S. GDP, I think the annualized growth rate has been, you know, roughly around 2%. Been a pretty decent, I guess you want to call 2% decent trend growth since the bottom of the recession, the Great Recession back in 2009. Forecasts going forward are a little bit tricky. Leading indicators are still pretty good. The series of LEIs that everybody likes to look at that are generally published pretty regularly in all the news reports look pretty good, although they have been weakening, suggesting that we're not going to get a lot of economic acceleration going forward. There are some other leading indicators I look at that have been pretty successful in the past as representing leading indicators into recession, or at least giving you some pretty good indication of where the odds might be. They're still positive, but they're not very positive. They're sort of on the cusp, bouncing around at the 50 level, which is relatively neutral, but staying there, you know, pretty solidly, I guess, if we can call it that, for the last couple of months. Those numbers really need to get below 50 for several consecutive months before the odds of recession really shoot up in a big way. Meanwhile, again, getting back to long-term trend growth, if you go back and look at calendar years, we haven't had a calendar year above 3% in more than 10 years in terms of real GDP. We've had some four quarters in a row where GDP has exceeded 3%, but not many. And, you know, that low growth not only reflects the aftermath of credit busts, which, and obviously what we had in 2008, 2009 was a big credit bust and real estate bust. It also reflects what's going on internationally, and world trade has been slowing significantly now for a number of years, particularly with respect to China, and that reflects the significant decline in commodity prices over the last 4 or 5 years and oil prices and whatnot. But at this point, while recession, I guess, is a possibility, it doesn't look like it's necessarily a fairly high probability. And I guess we have to also think about the future of recessions generally. In the past, when you had recessions, they were generally characterized by lots of layoffs, high unemployment, big declines in manufacturing, and so forth and so on. Well, with the exception of China and some other emerging areas of the world where they made big bets on recovery, too big, really, and we have a lot of excess capacity. In this country, we never really got a lot of momentum going in the first place. So you don't have a lot of excesses that need to be corrected. Housing bounced back, but not very strongly. Manufacturing came back, but again, you know, not very strongly. So we don't seem to have a lot of excesses that would, I guess, send the economy into a deep recession at this point, because of, just to use a phrase we've used before, if you never get off the runway, it's kind of hard to crash. And that seems to be where we are. But in terms of the National Bureau that decides whether we've had a recession or not after they've considered all the numbers, it's conceivable in the future that the judgment they use is qualitative. It's not really quantitative in the final analysis. It's entirely possible going forward that, you know, looking back, you'll see some 1% quarters, maybe several in a row, that turned out to be zero or slightly negative, and nobody knew it at the time, and it only turns up in retrospect when the numbers are recalculated and you look back and say, hey, we had a recession, and nobody really called it that. That's just speculation on my part, but I think that's probably likely going forward, that the recessions we were used to in the past, the normal type of recession, you know, won't really characterize what kind of recessions we have in the midst of a, you know, a pretty tepid 2% growth rate. But that seems to be the story now. A recession is not likely in the immediate future, but neither is a significant you know, increase in economic activity.
John, switching gears a little bit, one thing that we've talked about on this call for years is the long-term viability of the European Union. And for a long time, you know, Grexit was kind of the catchphrase where, you know, there was the possibility and still is the possibility that Greece were to exit on its own will or be kicked out, and, you know, that could also, you know, be some of the other weaker players in the European Union where they would, you know, leave the union and break up the union, some sort of scenario like that. Now, I guess this year the term is Brexit for British exit, and there's some talk about the UK leaving the European Union. And hopefully I have this right. I think there's going to be a vote on June 23rd.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. You know, where you know, that's a very real possibility. And I think a lot of polling data, you know, right now, it's still early, looks like it's, you know, it's very possible that that could occur. So first, talk a little bit about the likelihood and some of the reasons why. But then also, if it were to occur, what are the implications, not only for the European Union, but also our markets here in the U.S.?
The Brexit, let me talk a little bit first about the difference between Britain's relationship to the European Union and Greece as part of the Eurozone. The Eurozone is about 28 countries that share a common currency, the euro. Greece went off the drachma whenever they joined the Eurozone, and now the euro is the currency. And of course, you know, having different political entities and a single currency and no ability of the countries themselves to act in a monetary sense on their own has created some real issues in the Eurozone. That goes back to a lot of commentators at the time the Eurozone was formed about the fact that it would probably not likely be likely to survive in its present form unless they had some sort of political union, which hasn't been the case. And in contrast, Britain's relationship, and I won't go into all the details, but Britain's relationship with the European Union is loosely based on that concept wherein Britain agrees to follow certain rules and regulations, and they actually pay some money to support the donate some money every year to support the European Parliament. But it's a looser arrangement, but it does require that Britain agree to, you know, certain terms and conditions to remain a member of the European Union and get some of the, at least what everybody thinks are, trade positives by doing so. But with the fracturing of any cohesiveness in the European Union has come the rise of national anti-establishment parties in various countries, and a rise in the idea that we want national solutions to our problems and not so much a regional solution to our problems. So in a general sense, what Brexit is all about is Britain deciding that we don't like some of the rules and regulations that we have to follow, and we're going to do some or pursue some national solutions that we think will work best for us. Now, the economic view of all of that is that it will be more detrimental to Britain than they'll get on the positive side if they do decide to leave the European Union. But certainly, as you said, it could be a fairly serious issue if Britain were to vote to leave the European Union. It would call into question even more so the viability of the Eurozone as it currently exists. And there would be some market impacts and some currency issues, I guess, as this thing spread out like, ripples from a stone tossed in a pond. We'll have to see how it goes, but I think right now the odds are no better than 50-50 that Britain will remain in the as a member of the European Union. So that whole situation over there is fragile and disturbed and in transition from, you know, what was to something that will be. And right now, nobody knows exactly what that will be. But Greece, of course, as you mentioned, is continually on the edge. Mario Draghi and the European Central Bank have managed to, you know, calm things down from the crisis levels that existed in 2011, but the problems are still there and they haven't been resolved. And Greece is a complete basket case. They're being overrun by refugees, and the European Union, to a degree, is putting a lot of pressure on Greece to do something about all the people that are entering the country illegally and spreading out throughout Europe. So they're thinking about closing the borders, putting a lot more pressure on Greece. Greece got irritated about a meeting that happened in Austria recently and recalled their ambassador. So there's a lot of stuff simmering underneath what sometimes people might think is a relatively calm surface, because you don't hear as much about it as you used to. But the situation is really getting worse and not better. A combination of slow growth, a banking establishment that never has completely recovered from the crash and is not supplying the credit that everybody thinks they should be to get the economy going again. Italy, for example, last count, 17-18% of Italian bank loans were no good, or at least were considered bad loans, which is not a very good thing at all. So the situation over there is still unsettled and uncertain, and I guess we're just going to have to live with that for a while. But the idea that national solutions as opposed to cooperative regional policy solutions has become the goal, I guess, for a lot of countries there is not particularly positive. And to some degree, I think that's what's facing all of the economies nationally, the idea that we're going to get a lot of cooperative policy decisions that, you know, might improve the economic outlook anytime soon is probably not likely, which means, I guess, we're going to have to live with this, you know, unsettled world for a while longer.
And John, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but, you know, could this vote also force a lot of other countries to look at you know, they're continuing to remain in the union, or possibly, you know, there's been some talk about other unions forming, whether it be a Northern European Union. I mean, I guess everything, you know, this is going to potentially snowball into a lot of other countries self-evaluating, I would think.
Yeah, it sure could. That's the big concern. And, of course, once you get into these periods of transition, you really don't know exactly what's going to come out of it or really how messy it might be. And for any country to leave the Eurozone, it would be pretty messy for a while as you tried to work out all of the currency issues. Some people think it would be almost impossible without a lot of disruption. If Britain votes to leave the European Union, I've seen guesses that it might take a year or 2 years to work it out. In the meantime, of course, you'd have all these other things going on, as you mentioned, that other countries thinking that maybe it's in their best interest to do something else too. And, you know, you just continue the you know, the turmoil and the, you know, relatively low growth situation that we've got now.
Okay. More to come. Greg, let's talk about the stock market a little bit. February, at least as far as U.S. stocks are concerned, I don't think, you know, without doubt the best way to describe it is a flat month. S&P 500 down 0.1%. The Russell 2000, a measure of small cap stocks, was basically unchanged when you factor in dividends, right at zero. And then international stocks down a little bit more, down 1.3%. So on the surface, doesn't look all that exciting, but, you know, volatility, especially in the front half of the month of February, was very high. The VIX, which is a measure of volatility, hit about is almost the highest in 6 months. Back on February 11th. So volatility remains. Second half of the month, it looked like things firmed up a little bit, which I guess is a positive news. But give us a breakdown of what worked well, what didn't, from a sector standpoint, and then kind of talk a little bit about the month and where you think we're heading.
Yeah, it was really kind of a repeat of January, where we started off negative and then rallied, although January, I think it was the 18th, 19th and 20th before the market bottomed and turned up. This month, it was around the 11th. Actually, mid-caps and small-caps, as measured by the S&P 400 and 600, were actually up 1.4 and 1.1%, respectively, so the smaller capitalization issues did do a little bit better. For the month, the best performing sectors in this order were materials up about 7.6, industrials up about 4%, telecom services were up 2.7%, utilities up 1.9, consumer discretionaries up 0.38, and staples up 0.13. So 6 out of the 10 sectors were positive. The negatives were healthcare, which was down about 0.5%. Technology stocks down about 1.2%, energy down 1.9%, and financials down 2.9%. So, you know, again, at least March so far is positive. So looking ahead, hopefully if oil doesn't continue to spiral down, I'm thinking that, you know, perhaps the market finally has achieved a level of rationality, at least cross our fingers that way. So, some areas of the market, as I said, mid-caps and small-caps seem to be doing well. Taking a longer picture, the trailing 12 months, materials have been down about 16.8%. The worst, of course, was energy down 24.21%. Then financials also have taken it on the chin. They were down about 11.6% for the trailing 12 months. And then things go into the single digits with information technology for down 4.27, healthcare down 6.93, and discretionary stocks down 0.39. The only positive sectors in the trailing 12 months were telecom services up 7.5, utilities up 6, and consumer staples up 4, traditionally very defensive areas of the market. So, given the volatility that you mentioned and, of course, the negative returns that we've had over the last couple of months and the worry about a global recession, it's not surprising that more defensive areas have done better. And, of course, a lot of money, I think, has also gone into kind of a flight to quality into safe haven assets like higher-grade fixed income indices are up. So you see money going out of stocks. So, but, again, I think it was Russia and OPEC supposedly committed to stabilize oil price or oil production, I should say, at January levels. And the market seemed to like that. So whether or not they, of course, remain true to their promises, I think, you know, we still got the issue of volatility. And if production goes up and prices in oil continue to decline, I think the markets could go negative again. But, you know, as John mentioned, that there are some positives out there that perhaps we are going to have closer to a 2% growth rate in the first quarter. And I think that's going to be a key feature going forward is once we get a look at those first quarter numbers on whether or not earnings maybe perhaps bounce back and that the market stabilizes and does a little bit better. Again, our exposure to the emerging markets in China is very minimal at best. So really, if we were to slip back into a recession, it would probably be, in a way, our own fault because the consumer retrenches and becomes negative and doesn't spend. Because, once again, we are a consumer-based economy. So I think those are the numbers that I'm going to be focusing on and trying to get a little bit better feel for what this market's going to do for the balance of the year.
Okay. Thank you much, Greg. Jeff Tangus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Well, a lot of volatility in stocks and I guess a lot of excitement in the bond market as well. And I guess one thing that we've seen more and more headlines about recently is negative interest rates. I think there's four or five countries now that have negative interest rates, Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, Japan. I may be leaving one or two out. It's a concept, and we've been getting some client questions about it. It's a concept that people aren't very familiar with. Talk a little bit about just the pure mechanics of what that means. And, you know, is there a likelihood that it occurs here in the U.S.?
Well, we have been getting a lot of questions about it because it's such a new concept and something that kind of runs contrary to common sense in a lot of ways. Essentially what it means is when central banks around the world have employed all the traditional tools that they have to jumpstart economies, as in Europe or Japan or China, they're looking for new ways to force banks to lend money. Banks, the banking system normally holds deposits with the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve will pay those banks interest, a small interest rate on those deposits to hold for them, because the banks don't have, can't find enough good loan prospects out there to lend this money out. Well, what the Federal Reserve does is to encourage banks, or more importantly, I guess, to force banks to make more loans and then hopefully generate economic activity, is they would then, instead of paying banks interest on their deposits, they would actually charge banks to hold their deposits. Now, what that forces banks to do, it could do two things. It could say, well, we'll go out and we'll lend that money out, which is what the Federal Reserve hopes happens. The other alternative is that banks just start charging their own customers to take their deposits, which has happened in Europe already. So it's a concept employed by central banks. We haven't done it here in the United States. As a matter of fact, Janet Yellen met with Congress in February, and they asked her if negative rates was something that they had looked at and had and were permitted to do. And Janet Yellen kind of punted. She said that she wasn't aware of anything that that would prevent them from doing it if they decided that was something they needed to do, but that they really hadn't looked into it in any great degree. I suspect she was sort of just hedging herself a little bit there. I suspect they have looked into it, but in any event, she really didn't give a solid answer either way. So that, in a nutshell, is what negative rates are all about. It's trying to generate some economic activity But to kind of give you a picture, you were right on your country list there. Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, and Japan are the four so far. The Eurozone Central Bank also has some version of that. The net result is, if you just look at 2-year government bond yields around the world, 7 European countries have negative 2-year government bond interest rates, including Italy and Spain, which is, if you remember not long ago, John Portwood talked about what a economic basket case those two countries were. They were struggling and had problems, but even they have negative interest rates now, and then Japan. So 8 countries around the world have negative interest rates on their government securities. U.S. probably doesn't do that. That would politically be a big issue for them, especially in an election year. It doesn't appear like there's any reason that our economy growing 2%-ish is strong enough that it really wouldn't warrant any action of that sort. But in Europe, where the most recent, the February inflation numbers came out and were actually negative, so that they're having bouts of deflation again in Europe, that's a different situation where they're having to look again hard at negative interest rates and possibly implementing more there.
All right. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the bond market, U.S. Treasury. I'll just talk about the 10-year, and then I'll let you give us some color on other parts of the curve and other sectors of the market. I was looking at the 10-year this morning. We started the year at 227. In the January, 192. During the month of February, went as low as 166 and finished the month at 173. So really dramatic drop in rates on the 10-year, more than 50 basis points. Is that all attributable to volatility in the stock market, or is there concerns about inflation or deflation, all of the above? What do you think?
Well, certainly the lack of inflation is the number one factor there. Certainly the Fed raised rates in December, and since that increase in December, we've had an even more dramatic decline in the price of oil. That means inflation expectations continue to come down. That's number one. There's been a lot of scientific, or a lot of studies, I should say, about why interest rates are so low on government securities. The net result is that essentially people are requiring less yield to invest for longer terms, even outside of whatever their expectation for inflation is. So they call it the term premium. But essentially that's what's happening. People are just requiring lower return on their money, I guess, because as they look around in the investing world, rates for everything have come down. So it's a combination of things, but it really is the number one factor has got to be inflation, or the lack of inflation that's out there, and the likelihood that inflation rate is likely to stay low for an extended period of time.
All right. Jeff, thank you very much. It's right at 9:30, so I think we'll go ahead and end the call there. Please join us again next month, Tuesday, April 5th. And, you know, I know a lot of people are probably wondering why we didn't talk about the election. We discussed the possibility of discussing it today, but I think we'll have a lot more clarity. We have many more months to discuss the election, and I think when we reach April, I feel very confident that will be on the menu for us to discuss. So join us on April 5th for our next call. Thank you very much.